Welcome to Remarkable Retail Podcast, Season 3, Episode 20. I'm Michael LeBlanc.
And I'm Steve Dennis.
Well, listeners or viewers, if things look and sound a bit different, they are. Steve, where are you coming to us broadcasting live from, I think, the other side of the world still? Tell us, where are you?
Yeah, I'm in the United Arab Emirates. The particular emirate I'm in at the moment is Abu Dhabi. I'm in my fabulous hotel room.
Very nice.
But
very nice.
Earlier in the week, I was over in Dubai speaking at the MENA Retail Congress. Couple day congress or event that is, I think, the longest standing retail related event in the Middle East. A lot of shopping center people, a lot of retailers there. So it was a great deal of fun and quite interesting.
Well, and you and I were talking off mic about some of the shopping malls and both scale and scope. You know, it's a great, it's so great to, you know, yeah. I'm a bit envious. It's so great to get out and see the world again, kind of back to the before time where you can actually, you know, walk in different places and experience them. At a top line, top level, any early impressions from, now you've been over to that side of the world before, but any early impressions from what you saw today or this week?
Well, it's really a booming area. There continues to be a ton of construction. UAE has got a very high vaccination rate and has a little app, kind of a vaccine passport. Mm. So people are out and about. Many listeners might know there are some pretty over-the-top malls here, a few of which I got to visit. One that I saw earlier this week has 1,000 stores in it and 13 anchors. That's
wow.
The Mall of the Emirates in Dubai.
Wow.
And you know, a lot of global brands, a lot of brands that are really specific to the region, but booming economy. I mean, just apartments, office buildings, tourist attractions being built everywhere. So it's a lot of fun to see.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm sure you're still processing. So I'm sure your insights will kind of roll out during season four as we kind of talk about different things. Just great context, right? It's just wonderful context to be out and seeing new things. So for this episode, we've got a great episode ahead. We've got Elram Goren, who is the co-founder and CEO of Fabric, which is micro-fulfillment robotics. So you and I have just been both so fascinated by both, to some degree, the technology, but also just the strategy behind, you know, fulfillment, competing by having product where it is getting out of the back of the store or the side of the store. So it's a great interview, and it really opens our minds up, I think, to the possibilities. And so anyway, I really enjoyed talking to Elram. It was a good interview.
Yeah, I feel like there's this intersection, which I'm sure we'll keep coming back to in some way, shape, or form, this intersection between the hyper growth of online grocery. You know, that was the category, huge category, that went from very low e-commerce penetration pre-pandemic to, I think it's about doubled in the last couple of years. So that's an interesting trend. And then there's this whole idea that we get into about how to make, how to improve the profitability of last mile delivery. So, which goes beyond grocery, as we talk about. So yeah, it's very, very interesting topic. And I think there'll be a lot of news about that going forward.
Well, and it's a hot topic amongst the retailers I talk to. Many are either considering it, it's on their radar screen, and some are actually in the middle of doing it. So we're not talking about potential or theory here. It's a really burgeoning part of the retail equation. So speaking of burgeoning part of the retail equation, that's a rough transition there for you. let's talk about news of the week. So have you been keeping your eye on what's happening back on this side of the world? What are your thoughts, and what do you want to lead off with this week?
Well, I have, you know, when the jet lag strikes me, I get on my computer and I just read, you know, go to CNBC or Wall Street Journal or whatever and see what's going on. Well, we are, I think, in the last week of big earnings announcements for the quarter, and there were, once again, quite a lot of them. My takeaway, I kind of put them into two buckets. There were the earnings that came from legacy retailers or retailers that have been around for a while. I guess you could call them analog native or not necessarily direct to consumer. And for the most part, earnings were pretty strong, both sales and earnings. Costco reported, Lululemon reported, Restoration Hardware, and they were all up very strongly on sales, all had margin improvement, very strong operating performance. RH is the one, I talk about RH in my book. I guess, I don't know, Do you want to do the announcement about our final guest, or shall I do the announcement?
Well, since you mentioned it, why don't I tee you up to hit the ball out of the park, so
to speak. I'll spike.
Yes. Our season 3 finale interview, this gentleman mentioned RH when he thought of great examples of brand and retail. And this gentleman, actually, as a teaser, was a part of your first book launch, and he is the one and only.
Yes. Scott Galloway, the big dog, will be joining us. So we have already recorded that episode, so we do know what he talks about. And we talks about RH, and RH is one of those brands that really continues to fight against the narrative. I often talk about them, as I mentioned, I talk about them in my book, I talk about them in my keynotes. They're they've invested in these really palatial stores, and their digital capabilities are okay, but they're certainly not a digital first brand by any stretch of the imagination. And they have continued to gain market share. They've continued to open stores, and blockbuster sales performance and margin performance, the stock has continued to skyrocket. Yeah. On the flip side of that are a number of reports from our digitally native direct-to-consumer brands, and they're all pretty anywhere from bad to disappointing. Rent the Runway reported their sales were up a lot, and folks know Rent the Runway does what the name sounds like, but their sales were up a lot comparing to a really dismal quarter last year. But despite that big sales increase, they actually lost more money. Chewy's, the pet supply company, had also pretty strong sales growth, about 24%, looking at my notes, and margin expanded, but they also, there's some one-time expenses in there, but they're best case kind of breaking even. And I think we talked about Chewy's last quarter, they were sort of in this perfect position where they got this big bump from things moving to online, and all the pandemic puppies seemed to be driving a lot of sales. So their stock took a big hit. And then the last one I'll mention is Stitch Fix, which has been public for a while now. They've had really kind of a roller coaster ride. Sales have continued to increase. They broke even, I think, for a couple of quarters. Now they're losing money again. So I think this is just all part of this narrative of kind of how surprising it is that some of these brands that have gotten a big gift from the pandemic in terms of a lot of the new customer acquisition and a lot of marketing costs going down, still just having a hard time making any money. The thing I think to watch out for, and we got into this on our Profitless Prosperity episode, is I personally think for most of these brands that have been around for a while, it seems to me like it could only get tougher going forward. There's all these issues of, Apple's cookie policy. Acquisition costs are going up. Yeah. A lot of these companies are now investing in physical retail, which consumes a lot of capital. You don't have sort of the natural gift of traffic to online that you had in the pandemic time. So I think as we see more and more of these companies go public and we see more of their investor reports, we get to really dissect what's under the hood. So we'll see.
All right. Well, let's talk about Amazon. There's some news out about Amazon that you were sharing kind of off mic around, it's interesting, the multiple parts of their business model. This part looked at their seller fees. What did we learn this week?
Yeah, well, I think we're required by law to talk about Amazon in every episode. So this is our opportunity. I'm going to try to keep this brief. If people are interested, they should go check it out. But I thought this was an interesting story for a couple reasons. One, in our recent episode with Chris Bell on Perch, we were talking with him about all the merchants that are selling through the marketplace and all the fees that Amazon charges them, and whether at some point Amazon would basically squeeze those guys to maximize profit. This report talks about how much those fees have gone up. The report from the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, which is a great name, says that 34% of all revenue made by third-party sellers will go to Amazon, which is up from 26% in 2017 and 19% in 2014. Now, Amazon, to be fair, has pushed back, saying that report is not accurate. But I think it speaks to two things. One, this potential squeeze on the third-party market, which has become such a huge part of Amazon. But the second piece which really gets to this narrative about that people still believe that Amazon doesn't make any money in retail. Well, this is the part of the business where they absolutely make a ton of money because they do charge some pretty hefty fees and they don't carry any inventory. And there's a lot of really positive financial dynamics in the flywheel. So again, this third-party marketplace activity has obviously become humongous for the whole industry, but a really important driver for Amazon. And there's at least some indications that maybe some of the third-party sellers are starting to get squeezed. So that's the problem of becoming too reliant, perhaps, on Amazon.
Well, there's a great roundup, great stories. Let's get to our interview with Elram, again, from the co-founder and CEO at Fabric. And as a reminder, our next episode is our last episode of the season. We're going to take then a bit of a hiatus until January. If all things go well, get together, you and I, for a in-person session at the NRF. I've described our podcast as the pandemic puppy of podcasts, because you and I never actually been in the same physical place since we started the podcast. So, that'll be just a pile of fun. And our season finale is such a great episode. We've already had the interview, so we know it's a great interview, wide-ranging, spot-on insights from the one and only Scott Galloway, so be sure and tune into that. But for now, let's get to Elram at Fabric. Elram, welcome to the Remarkable Retail Podcast. How are you doing this afternoon?
Well, thank you very much. I'm doing well. Thank you for having me.
Fantastic. Now, where are we finding you today? I think you mentioned you were coming to us live from the Big Apple. Do I have that right today?
That is true. I'm talking to you from our offices here in New York City.
Let's jump right in. So tell us about your background, you personally, and what you do at Fabric.
So I'm Elram Gorin. I'm one of the founders and the CEO at Fabric. Actually, in my training, I'm an electrical engineer, studied electrical engineering and physics back in Tel Aviv, Israel, here at Carnegie Mellon, and then kind of came back to Israel, spent about 10 years in the defense sector, mm-hmm. and kind of was trained there in Israel. And that was before we started what was then called Common Sense Robotics and today Fabric. That was in 2015 when we established the company. And since then, we had our first round of funding in early 2016. We were four founders back then. And today kind of running the company at about 300 people in Tel Aviv, Israel, and here in the States.
Well, tell us all about your business. Tell us about Fabric, the origin story. You've hinted at it already in terms of getting together with counterparts. What's the scope and scale of the business? Where do you operate? Give us all that sense of what you do.
Actually, it's a fascinating story. I'll start from the, you know, where we are today and what we do. So Fabric is in the micro-fulfillment space, which means that we're building tools or technologies and services that enable retailers, mm-hmm. in this case, to offer on-demand fulfillment services at sustainable unit economics. That's what we do, and we can spend some time on what micro-fulfillment really is and what kind of value it creates to these businesses. At its core, micro-fulfillment is a new, or I should say a novel way to think about supply chains, which is based not on the convention of economies of scale and consolidating operations, rather on distributing the supply chain to a network of smaller locations where you do pick and pack operations, and from there you do last mile deliveries. And you're doing this to combine the benefits of fast, low cost, last mile operations with the benefits of highly efficient, high throughputs, and fast fulfillment operations. And the only way to do that really is by injecting technology into those operations, because the fact of the matter is that if you go micro, you're actually going against economies of scale, and your mm-hmm. things are actually harder when you're doing them smaller, at least in this space. And so the company's engine or heart is in its technology, And that technology is really what allows us to do what we do. But at the end of the day, what we do is provide those technologies or fulfillment services to other retailers so that then they can serve their own customers with on-demand experiences at sustainable costs.
Now, at the heart of it, this is a bit of a chicken and egg, or I should say robot and warehouse question. Which came first? Like, did you see, you and your partners see the opportunity for micro-fulfillment, or did you create physical robots or robotic technology or software that runs it and then say, let's go looking for an application? Which came first?
Well, that's really, it's a great question because it touches on how we started and why we're actually doing this today. So I'll give you some background. I mean, the founders of Fabric, we didn't come from supply chain. We didn't come from logistics, and we didn't come from retail. In fact, when I usually tell the story, I usually tell folks that when we started the company, I thought that fulfillment is just a feeling. And and that's true. We had no idea what fulfillment really meant. What we did was, so when we started the company, we started it by, or when we started this journey, I should say, we started it by thinking as engineers, and we were kind of inventing these cool solutions and then trying to look for problems that those solutions can solve for. That did not work very well. And so the first...
It is about a roundabout way to success, for sure.
Right, right. But you'd be amazed how many initiatives actually start and usually, I think, fail due to that approach. And we've spent, 6 months doing that process until we figured out that we might need to kind of change our approach. And since we didn't kind of really come from any industry that we felt that we can contribute to, because we came from the defense industry and we weren't interested in going back there, we started thinking about problems that we face as consumers, because that's something that we felt that we at least knew it was a problem. And we started thinking about this idea of what if we could get our groceries faster and cheaper than going to the supermarket if we shop them online. Now, as mentioned, we had no idea how retail worked. We had no idea how the supply chain behind that worked. So we didn't know what denied us from that experience. And so what we did was start to investigate how things actually work. And we spent the next 12 months almost in understanding and basically reverse engineering the P&Ls of the businesses that we thought or we wanted to serve, right? Talking to folks in the industry and really identifying what was broken, right? What denied that from happening? And what we've learned along that way is that supply chains are actually not built for on-demand. They're not built for on-demand from a functionality perspective, meaning, the speed and inventory availability to actually deliver the right items at the right time. They're not built for that from a unit economics perspective. We've learned that in groceries, at least, and then, we've learned that in other sectors as well. Most retailers are just losing money on every order, whether it's on-demand or not. So making it on-demand just made it worse. And third, it wasn't really built for scale. So that's how we started, right? We didn't start from a very deep or any familiarity with the, with the business that we were about to serve. And I think in hindsight, that actually helped us.
Well, you weren't constrained by pre-existing notions, right? Sometimes there's an advantage of, we don't know anything about this, so you don't go in assuming this is how it must be, right? You come from a very different place.
I think you're right. I think what's unique about what Fabric is doing is that its goal is to make on-demand something that's accessible to everyone in unit economics that do not dilute the business rather feel it. So that's where who we are.
So Ken, it's really interesting, not only the specifics of what you're doing, but we talk a lot on the podcast about what it takes to bring innovation to life. And I think it's so fascinating that you saw this opportunity really from outside. I've got a bunch of questions. I'm trying to think about how to boil them down. But one is, can you maybe help people that aren't as familiar with the supply chain or fulfillment in general, kind of understand how you fit in and what some of the challenges are? Because one of the things we've talked about a couple of times, and I talk about in my book and my keynote a little bit, is that my perception was, if you go back to the 90s for sure, the supply chain, and you kind of touched on this, but the supply chain was really built, you know, there's a set of things that were done largely to supply stores, and there were a set of things that were largely done to support mail order catalogs, which eventually became e-commerce, principally, you know, pick, pack, and ship, but really from a regional perspective. And there wasn't an ability to do same day, next day, or, you know, even same hour kind of delivery. But COVID seemed to have really has propelled this to the next level. But most, might tell me if I'm wrong, but most retailers have largely, because they don't have what Amazon has with so many local distribution, last mile delivery centers, they've largely solved for it by making their stores the last mile delivery hub. Is that true? And then how do you see that playing? Because Michael and I have talked about, sorry, it's a very long-winded question, but Michael and I have talked a lot about the unit economics of this, being that it's always going to be better, it would seem, from a grocer's perspective or any retailer's perspective, to have the customer do the work to come to the store rather than having to pay somebody to do it. And you also get the opportunity to sell them something else. But clearly, just because that works for you, that doesn't mean that's what the consumer wants. So with that very crazy backdrop, if we can find the essence of a question in there, is how has this evolved? How do you see it evolving? And more specifically, how you see Fabric fitting in and micro-fulfillment fitting into that evolving landscape?
The way retail, whether it's, you know, brick and mortar or e-commerce, evolves, and thus the way that the supply chains for those different formats evolved, it's sort of like the industry created a few species, right, that are kind of living these days. So there's the Amazon one where it's almost entirely fulfillment centers in different sizes, different locations, perhaps for different SLAs in terms of service speed, and then there are the stores, which were built for a certain experience, and are definitely assets for that experience. And then as e-commerce grew, then you're seeing players with those types of assets trying to leverage those to serve their e-commerce business. You're seeing this with Target, you're seeing this with Walmart, you're seeing this with others. So they're trying to do two things. One is to leverage them to grow the e-commerce business, but also what they're also trying to do is avoid those assets becoming more liabilities, right? Because if e-commerce is growing and brick and mortar is not growing, right, then the unit economics of those assets are changing, right? And the viability, the financial viability of those assets is definitely changing. So there are those two kind of different ways to approach this. I think what Fabric is doing, so at its core, Fabric is building or has built a local automated fulfillment platform that allows us to deploy this technology in a fulfillment center. That's sort of a dark operation, meaning customers do not engage it in any way. But you could also deploy it within a store. So we're actually pretty indifferent to the type of supply chain that that our customers are using it for. And I think that's one of the bigger benefits of that ability to be indifferent, and that elasticity that's baked into the technology that allows it to be deployed in a 40,000 square foot facility, like a larger micro fulfillment center, or a 6,500 square foot facility. That's our kind of our first micro fulfillment center, or a store,
right?
Bring fulfillment closer to the end customer while enjoying the benefits of automation. And again, that combination is really the first time where, you know, retailers can enjoy both the benefits of truly a last mile operation and the benefits of automation.
I think that's helpful. Well, it's a complicated, and, you know, we don't want to get too much into history or inside baseball here around, you know, all the aspects of the supply chain, if only because, you know, I would run out of gas on my knowledge pretty quickly. But I'm interested on your general perspective. One of the things I've worried about or am worried about is it seems like this ever escalating battle is occurring for convenience. You know, it wasn't that long ago where Amazon moved a lot to, you know, 2-day delivery, which I think could still largely be accomplished by a lot of retailers that were, you know, the cost of it might have been high, but they could at least serve many parts of the country through a regional fulfillment center. But if you're going to do same day or 2-hour or whatever, you know, you can't have overnight from Federal Express to make that happen. You've got to have these local fulfillment centers. But the issue around the unit economics seems to be the big hurdle. I'm sure many of our listeners have seen some of the studies. I think McKinsey and Bain have both done studies about 90% of grocery deliveries lose money. So I'm very curious how much of this is kind of a race to the bottom, just kind of ever escalating competitive dynamics, and perhaps Amazon is just very intentionally pushing this because they know 98% of the volume won't, 98% of the volume on the part of competitors won't be profitable, and that'll ultimately work to their advantage. Versus, this is a really fundamental shift in the way retail is going to operate, and micro fulfillment in particular offers a way to solve, you know, not all these issues, but many of these issues. Where do you see this playing out, and what are some of the profit dynamics that you think people most need to pay attention to?
Well, let me address this way. There's a fairly famous quote by Jeff Bezos that said that, you know, customers will never complain about something that arrived too soon or too fast and it's too cheap and they got exactly what they wanted, right? So I think that if we start from there, I think it's going to be as viable as technology allows it to be. Meaning, I agree with you that there are some players like Amazon who can afford to run operations that others can't. Right? But then it's kind of up to companies like Fabric to build capabilities that will allow to push the envelope to a point where it actually does make sense, right? So if it did make sense to do same-day delivery and profitable unit economics, and I believe that more retailers would do that because I believe that consumers, at the end of the day, if they had a choice, they would prefer a more on-demand experience. Now, does that necessarily mean that every shopping experience has to be a 1-hour or 2-hour shopping experience? I don't believe so. I think it's actually the reality is a bit more complex, and there are some things that you would actually rather get tomorrow if it means that you're getting a larger variety, and maybe there are some cost advantages, and maybe there are sustainability advantages that you care about. So I don't believe it's necessarily everything right now. But I do believe that as long as technology pushes that envelope to a point where it's more possible to do those operations and to do them on demand and for those to be sustainable from a unit economics perspective, then I think you're going to see more demand for this. And the reason I'm saying this is, you know, when I usually have these conversations, and the way I like to think about things is maybe we shouldn't imagine that we're really inventing something here. Maybe we should try to take a look at what has happened in retail in, you know, the last 50 years, right? Because I actually don't believe that same day is new. I think that, you know, when I grew up, right, there wasn't any e-commerce, but if I had the choice of going to a store and getting, you know, that pair of shoes that day versus going to a store and getting it, you know, 2 days from that point in time, I think I would know what my choice would be, right? So a lot of those things are not necessarily that unique to e-commerce. In a way, same day was there a lot before, it was there a lot before in brick and mortar than it was in, than it is in, you know, in e-commerce. So I think if that possibility was open to more retailers and more consumers, you would see more movement towards on demand. But again, it doesn't necessarily mean that everything has to be on demand. And again, at the end of the day, I think it really comes down to what capabilities retailers have to actually offer this in a more sustainable way.
I like how you're tying together. It's funny when you put it the way you just put it, that, you know, you had on demand same day, you just got in the car and you went and got it, which ties back into,
right. I mean,
you want it now? Sure. We have it. It's in the
just take
store
it.
Right near you.
Come to our warehouse that we call a store.
Exactly. A couple of last questions for you, and you've been very generous with your time and insight. So thank you for that. Why and how, when you think about this intuitively, it makes a ton of sense, both strategically and tactically, to be able to, when it makes sense, to fulfill in your area from the stores where the product are, particularly if you're trying to close a gap from delivery, right? So the micro warehouse, highly automated. A, what kind of objections do you get when you talk to retailers and say, well, that may not be for us? I'm kind of curious, because it seems like that would be for many. Maybe it's just volume driven. And then B, and then this is another funny question, is particularly for someone leading a company that's so advanced, what's next? And maybe this is next, and maybe that's a short answer. But A, what are some of the reasons why people don't think about robotic self, you know, micro warehousing? And B, you know, what do you what's in the tickle trunk? What are you guys working on next?
I think for us next, you know, the coming year or so is going to be, I should say, the coming years, there are going to be a lot on execution.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Fabric has been fortunate enough to work with some of the leading brands out there, and there's a lot ahead of us in terms of, you know, proving, you know, the promise. Because micro fulfillment, I mean, with, you know, with all due respect to everything I just said, it's still in its kind of first steps. And there is a lot to prove. So a lot of it is going to be on execution, and we're very much focused these days on fast moving consumer goods segments like groceries and like health and beauty, because they really fit, or the pain points that they are experiencing,
mm-hmm.
they're being almost entirely resolved by the micro fulfillment center, mm-hmm. just that node, which ties to your other question about what's next. So when you think about micro fulfillment, one way to think about this is, okay, within those four walls of that small location close to end customers, there are these kind of cute robots that work together and fulfill, you know, a customer's order. But actually, when you think about kind of the broader context, then a micro-fulfillment center is just one piece of a larger on-demand supply chain.
Hmm.
And when we think about what's next, it's really about that. Because for example, for fast-moving consumer goods segments like groceries and like health and beauty, the local demand density is that high, and the complexity of assortment is that low, call it, that a micro-fulfillment center on its own would solve the majority of the issues that have to do with e-commerce fulfillment and economic sustainability. However, if you looked at segments like apparel, right, or electronics, those would experience not just the kind of the fulfillment challenges that groceries and health and beauty, kind of experience. They actually experience other challenges, like how do I make sure that the right item is in the right location at the right time? Because the inventory complexity or the assortment is much more complex. And the density is a lot lower. You can't afford to put, all items in all locations.
Right.
The reason I'm saying this is when we're thinking about what's next, it's really about how you're taking that micro fulfillment center and starting to think about a micro fulfillment network that links to the distribution layer and links to the last mile layer. And what we can say today is that we're seeing a lot of opportunities in building those networks. It also kind of shifts our thinking from kind of this thought that's more limited to the four walls of the micro fulfillment center again, to this type of thinking that starts at the city, right? So how do we serve a certain locale? How many centers do you need? How big they should be? How many retailers could you serve from the same location? And how could the network serve that retailer more effectively than a group of disconnected nodes that are not necessarily working together? And there are a lot of kind of interesting and cool benefits to that. I'm sure we could spend hours on that, but I'm sure, we have some limitations in terms of time. So I'll leave it at that. But when we're thinking about what's next, it's really about taking that to the next level.
Well, I do feel like we've just kind of seen the tip of the iceberg here, but you've done at least two things that we really like to do on this show, which is help us think about what's next in retail. And I think this is just such a fascinating area and a lot more to come, obviously. And also, I just love how you taught us a little bit something about how to bring innovation kind of outside in to a sector. So but thanks, Elram, so much for joining us and sharing your wisdom. One last question. If people want to learn more about you and learn more about Fabric, where should they go?
Well, first of all, thank you for the kind words. And I do appreciate you guys and appreciate you inviting us to speak here. And if folks want to learn more about Fabric, then just go to getfabric.com. Where you can find a lot of the information. And we'd love to continue this conversation.
Excellent. Well, thanks again, and happy holidays, and best of luck for incredible growth in 2022 and beyond.
Thank you very much. Really appreciate it, guys.
If you like what you heard, please follow us on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or your favorite podcast platforms. So you can catch up with all our great interviews. Subscribe so that just automatically shows up. Tell your friends, and also in new insights and new episodes will show up every week. So tell your friends, because that will help us share the word, the good wisdom. Now be sure and check us out on our new YouTube channel. Not so new anymore. We've got a couple of episodes up there, and just look for Remarkable Retail.
And I'm Steve Dennis. You can check out more of my work at my website, StephenPDennis.com, or on Forbes or on Twitter. And please check out my second edition of my book, Remarkable Retail, How to Win and Keep Customers in the Age of Disruption, available just about everywhere books are sold.
And I'm Michael LeBlanc, producer and host of the Voice of Retail podcast and a bunch of other stuff. You can find me on LinkedIn, learn about me on meleblanc.co. All right, Steve, great episode. Look forward to chatting again next week. Be safe, and have a great rest of your day.